you a little bit just about my background, a little so you understand the perspective that I'm going to share with you, because it is important whenever you discuss issues like end-of-life issues to know the person who's presenting a particular view in terms of their own background, their own orientation, because we all have the tendency of seeing things based on our own upbringing, our own educational background. So first of all, I just want to give you the name you have on the front of the packet. I just want to give you a phone number and an email. If at any time over the next, God willing, I may have asked for me if I can ever be of help, either in the rabbinate or in bioethics, please feel free to call on me. If not, that's perfectly fine as well. That's a cell phone. This is a home phone. This is an email. Phone number is 646-361-6815. Home phone 718-591-0056. And my email is rabbiethics, rabbiethics at juno.com. Just a little bit about myself so you have an idea where I come from. I come from Yeshiva University. I was born here, I grew up here, and so I went to college, Yeshiva College. I went through Smicha, spent 8 years here on campus. I also went to medical school in Detroit, where I'm from. I did an internship in general medicine at Maimonides Medical Center, then came back to the more illustrious, more lucrative field of the rabbinate. All right. Sometimes it gets a laugh, sometimes it doesn't. But in either case, I presently have the privilege of serving as rabbi of the Young Israel of Hillcrest in Queens, New York, and I'm also an adjunct assistant professor of biology at Stern College. My special interest, sub-interest, is bioethics, medical halacha, and the interface and the relationship between Jewish bioethics and secular or general bioethics. Just want to begin by referring you to an article that, when you have the chance to read, I think will be worthwhile. It appeared in the science section of the New York Times on October 10th, just 2 weeks ago. It's called The Last Word on the Last Breath. The Last Word on the Last Breath. It's an article that I think you'll find worthwhile, and there are, as demonstrated by that article, always articles appearing in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and other places about end-of-life issues. There is no issue that is more relevant, halacha l'maisa, that is more contentious, that is more important in terms of medical halacha, the end-of-life issues. Part of that you had last week when Rabbi Dr. Reichman, I think, presented last Thursday in terms of brain death and that. That's, if you will, like a subsection in part on end-of-life issues, though it certainly also overlaps with the issues of organ donation. That's where its primary ramification is. But end-of-life issues are the thing. And if you do go into the rabbinate, into what Rabbi Israel Miller, Olav HaShalom, described to me, if you go into clinical rabbinics, then that will be, in terms of medical halacha, the most serious and most common, perhaps, issue that you will face in terms of how to help families cope and approach, in terms of decision-making, end-of-life issues. A number of years ago, when I was an assistant rabbi at Fifth Avenue Synagogue, so there was a young woman who originally grew up in New York. She went to Ramaz for high school, but then she made Aliyah, married, has a little girl who's not so little anymore. She was divorced. She developed melanoma. Melanoma is a skin cancer, a very aggressive skin cancer. She developed malignant melanoma. I mean, I should say metastatic malignant melanoma, meaning her melanoma that was originally treated in Eretz Yisrael eventually spread. Metastasize means to spread throughout to other parts of the body through different means. There are different ways that metastases occur, but her melanoma metastasized. She came here to Sloan Kettering for treatment. Normally, so to speak, and that's an important point perhaps to begin with, normally the prognosis for someone with metastatic melanoma is about 6 months. She lived probably a year or so after that diagnosis, which speaks to the point that not only physicians and rabbis should bear in mind as well, that it's not only not necessarily accurate, but it's not necessarily helpful or productive to talk about specific time frames of how long a person has to live. It may be have relevance in terms of whether the person is expected to live a few more weeks or just a few more minutes in terms of notifying family, but in terms of having, if you will, empirical prognostic timelines is not necessarily realistic medically, nor is it necessarily productive or useful for families to hear that kind of specific information. But nonetheless, she lived beyond. When she was at Sloan Kettering, so her mother, who's a very educated woman, still lives in Yerushalayim, her mother, her daughter lives with the grandparents, had the privilege of visiting her. She was a little child when her mother died. Her mother died as she was a young woman in her 30s. She died Sloan Kettering. And I remember when she was in the intensive care unit at Sloan Kettering, so her mother was very aggressive in terms of wanting to do everything for her, even at points where she was perhaps not brain dead. She wasn't brain dead, but she was certainly, whether she was a ghostess or not, we'll discuss in a few minutes in terms of how to define ghostess, but nonetheless, she was clearly, from a medical clinical perspective, hopelessly and terminally ill. Terminally ill, meaning she had a terminal illness that would take her life, and that it was irreversible and was hopelessly terminally ill. But her mother wanted to be very aggressive, so her mother asked me in the course of a short period of time to contact different poskim. So I contacted on her behalf Rabbi Schechter, Shlita, my Rebbe, Rabbi Tendler, Shlita, and Rabbi J. David Bleich, one of my other Rebbeim, also my Rebbe, and shared with her their different views. She had her own mindset made up. I think that's also important to bear in mind for Rabbanim as well. I look at a Rav primarily as like a physician, meaning that you give advice and you make recommendations, and it's up to the patient or the congregant to take that information or that recommendation and employ it as they see fit. I my own view of Rabbanus is not to be imposing or to be coercive in any way. You have to take a stand, but that's different between trying to be coercive. So you give the information. It's also important to understand that different people have different perspectives. This mother, understandably, there's no one who can critique her for that, had a view. She wanted to do everything for her daughter. And she wasn't looking for Rabbi Tendler's view, which was a little bit more shevi al tasa, don't be so aggressive. She wasn't looking for Rabbi Schechter's view, which is oftentimes consistent with Rabbi Tendler's in this arena of medical halacha, being more of a shevi al tasa, more passive. She was looking for Rabbi Bleich's view, which in this arena is a more kumbase, certainly more aggressive, up to the point he has limits as well, Rabbi Bleich, but his limits go beyond what would considered to be part of most of the poskim. Now, I'm not saying wrong or right. I ask Rabbi Bleich Shilas all the time. I spoke to him the other day or so about things. But in terms of that, that's the view she was looking for. She was looking for Rabbi Bleich's view. She wasn't looking for Rabbi Tendler's or Rabbi Schechter's view. It's important to bear in mind. But the most important anecdote from that particular incident came when I remember sitting with a number of the physicians and the mother and the ICU physician at that time at Sloan Kettering. Don't want to give any identifying markers about the person, but that physician, I can honestly say, was not conducting him or herself professionally. It was very antagonistic to an extent. But I made the mistake, and I learned from that from one of the other physicians who was a lot more sensitive, and I want to share this with you to always bear in mind. I remember trying to explain in this conversation to the mother that basically the physicians feel there's nothing left for them to do for your daughter. There's nothing else they can do. And I was immediately corrected by one of the oncologists. I still remember this and made an impression on me, and I will never forget this lesson. He said, "That's not true," he said. "We have things we can do for her. We can keep her comfortable. We can do this. We can do that. We can't cure her." There's never a time, and it should never be said. I made that mistake once. I will never make that mistake again. It should never be said out of the mouth of a physician, a nurse, a rabbi, or anyone that there's nothing that we can do either for you, speaking to the patient, or speaking to the family for your family member. There's always something that you can do. When you read Igros Moshe, some of the sources that I give you, you'll see that same sentiment expressed by Reb Moshe as well, that there are always things that you can do. It may just be adjusting a pillow. It may just be adjusting the height of the bed. It may be just holding the hand. It may just be anything, but it may be just giving something. It may be something, whether it's medical or not. There's always something that you can do for a patient, just being there. You know, in Shulchan Aruch and Yoredeh, it talks about how serious it is to not leave a patient when they are in the state of dying alone. Never leave a patient alone. I remember I'll give you another anecdote from Rav Schechter. When my father, Olav HaShalom, was in a car accident due to whatever reasons, and then he was basically hospitalized for 11 months until he died. So I remember the day of the surgery, if I'm not mistaken, was an Erev Shabbos, was a Friday, and I was on the phone with Rav Schechter about what was going on, and we didn't really, I guess myself, my brother didn't necessarily arrange or think ahead of time in terms of who will be there on Shabbos or not. So needless to say, after that surgery, it was spinal surgery, my father obviously was not going to be awake. He was still under sedation and under anesthesia, and he would wake up at some time. So Rav Schechter asked me on the phone, who's going to be there when he wakes up, so that he shouldn't be alone when he wakes up and sees an empty room and perhaps gets anxious or startled or scared. Those kinds of aspects speak to what we would speak to in terms of what is halacha rufu. Halacha rufu is not just technical analyses of whether you're permitted to disconnect a ventilator or not. That is very important, very crucial. But never to displace out of one's mind what physicians refer to as the art of medicine. There's an art to halacha as well. There's an art to being a rabbi. And there's a way of not saying, well, this person, you're going to die in 6 months, giving that. The art is not to do that. And that's the nimusim, the musar, that we all learn in Shivas as well. In addition to technical halacha, the other part of halacha is the hashkafa halacha, that you see when you read the Chazon Ish's little sefer, Emuna Ubitachon. He talks about the fact that the halacha and nimusim and musar are one and the same, that ethics and halacha are not distinct entities or disciplines. They're all part of the same, and to always bear in mind these aspects when you're functioning as a rav, and bear in mind those little subtle things that can be very, very important. So I want to go through some of the makoros and hopefully impress you with certain basics. You could spend an entire lifetime studying end of life issues, and there are people who kind of do in a sense, both non-Jewish and Jewish to an extent. Dr. Steinberg, a pediatric neurologist at Shaar HaTzedek Hospital, was the head of a commission that was employed, if you will, by the Knesset to develop a law, a detailed legal approach in Eretz Yisrael, which was adopted by the Knesset not too long ago. I think it started in 2003, this endeavor, with a number of other professionals from various realms, and Dr. Steinberg was the one who was instrumental in putting this commission. It's known kind of as a Steinberg commission, but it developed a law which has been accepted and adopted by the Knesset in terms of how to approach end-of-life issues. There's an article in here which I've seen some of it, I forget the website. The article I have in here, actually Rabbi Dr. Reichman had sent me by email from ASIA, which reviews to some extent a number of the issues that panel developed. There's more detail you can find about it, but this is an issue that is very, very pervasive, end-of-life issues. But there's certain fundamental principles you have to be able to determine. So, for example, in halacha, we distinguish between kumba aseh and shevi al taseh. You know that in many areas of halacha, there's a difference between whether I actively do something or whether I passively just refrain from doing something. See, in medical ethics, those distinctions are not as clear. In non-Jewish, if you will, in secular medical ethics, whether one actively withdraws treatment or whether one actively withholds treatment are treated basically as equivalent. Where in halacha, actively withdrawing treatment, like disconnecting a patient from a ventilator, is generally assumed to be bekumba aseh, an active intervention, which is not mutter, according to most poskim, as opposed to shevi al taseh, passively, let's say passively not resuscitating a patient if their heart and lungs stop functioning. In halacha, that's important to bear in mind, because in general medical ethics, that distinction either is non-existent or it has a lesser definition that is consistent with halacha. That's one important idea to bear in mind as we go through the makoros. The difference between kumvase and shevi al tasa. Meaning, kumvase, no one in the posting would say that I can ever actively shorten a person's life. But I can, according to all poskim, at times, and poskim differ as to when those times arrive, or whether they ever really do in reality, but I can at times just sit back and be passive and not intervene. But to intervene in an active way as to expedite the patient's demise, their death, that I'm never permitted to do. Where in medical ethics in general, oftentimes that is permissible. So kumvase, shevi al tasa is important. It's also important to bear in mind differences between patients who are terminally ill, like, for example, people with terminal cancer, and another example that we'll go through in the Makoros, as opposed to somebody who's hopelessly ill. An example of somebody who's hopelessly ill, which is a very important issue. Somebody, everyone got back in the races, my phone numbers, my email, 646-361-6815, so wait, 91056, got it? Okay. It's in Tchelis Blue. One of the members of my congregation just gave me, I don't wear Tchelis, at least not yet. So one of the members of my Kehila just gave me a gift of Tchelis. So I have to decide what to do, because I wasn't, at least at this point, motivated, maybe I should, but I haven't been to put on tchelis. But now somebody from the Kehila gave me tchelis, and said they would put it on for me. So I have to bear in mind. So that's a different issue for another time. Perhaps Rabbi Dr. Reichman made reference to this entity last week in contrasting it to somebody who's in a state of brain death. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, very good. Somebody who's in a persistent vegetative state, PVS, persistent vegetative state. The most famous person who was in a persistent vegetative state years ago was Nancy Cruzan. She was a young woman, I'm trying to remember the state, but she was a young woman in the early 90s who was in a car accident. She was resuscitated and she was in hospital. She was in a persistent vegetative state. Another classic example of somebody in a persistent vegetative state more recently was Terry Schiavo. Terry Schiavo case. She was in a persistent vegetative state. The fundamental difference between a persistent vegetative state and somebody with brain death is somebody who's in a persistent vegetative state. See, if you look at the neurologic system, specifically the central nervous system, so if you look at the brain in particular, so there is the brain and largely occupied by the cerebral cortex. The cerebral cortex is responsible for cognitive function, the ability to understand Rashi, Tosos, everything else like that, creative abilities, ability to speak, ability to appreciate sensations, pain, cold, touch, all of those things, cognitive in terms of awareness, being aware. The brain stem is responsible for a number of vegetative functions, quote unquote, namely the ability to breathe. Doesn't require any cognitive ability to breathe. It's a function of the brain stem. And the ability to be awake is also a function of the brain stem. Ability to be awake, arousal, being awake. Somebody who's in a persistent vegetative state has... And if they're persistent, persistent meaning for an extended period of time, meaning you can't define somebody who's in persistent vegetative state for a few days. There are different criteria in the literature, but certainly several months, or certainly 2-3 months at the very least. I mention that only because oftentimes doctors might say, well, this person is already in a persistent vegetative state. That's not necessarily the case. There's certain criteria that have to be met. Sometimes you'll hear doctors say this person is brain dead. And it's not necessarily the case, because sometimes, maybe once every day, the person takes a breath on their own. By definition, they're not brain dead. It's important to bear in mind, as a rav, that not everything that is necessarily articulated by a physician is necessarily correlated to the clinical reality. That doesn't mean they're trying to fool anybody, but they're just saying that's what they are, using it in general terms. But you have to be technically correct. But a persistent vegetative state, somebody who's in a vegetative state, meaning that their brain stem functions, They can breathe oftentimes, most of the time, on their own. Most persistent vegetative state patients do not need ventilators because their brainstem is intact. They can breathe on their own. They can function on their own. They can continue to live for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. Terry Shive, I don't remember how long she was like that, but she was like that for an extended period of time, a number of years. They can live years like that. They're not terminal. They're hopelessly ill because their disease is in their cerebral cortex. They have no cognitive function. They have no level of awareness. They have no ability to interact or perceive anything going on around them, and presumably, they have no ability to appreciate pain, which is an important clinical and halakhic consideration. So they're in a persistent, meaning that it's not something that is temporary, it is persistent and presumably irreversible, a vegetative state. Their vegetative functions are still operative. They can be fed. They can't eat because they're not conscious. They can't eat on their own. They're not aware. They have to be fed, but they can be fed with a feeding tube. They can, all their normal function of the body allowing them to live physiologically continues. They have no awareness of anyone around them. They have no appreciation of pain. They don't understand anything that's being said, presumably. They can't hear anything, presumably. They can't see anything. They may open their eyes. They may actually sleep and open their eyes at times. And you think that they're aware, but they're not. Because awakeness is not dependent on the cerebral cortex. Awakeness or wakefulness is based on the brainstem. A person can be awake and totally non-cognitive. A person, Rabbi Tendler likes to make jokes about that at times, but we'll leave those aside. But nonetheless, people can be totally awake and they can be awake and alert, but not cognitive or aware. And so Terry Schiavo, I think from some of the pictures on TV, was maybe opening her eyes and maybe looking as if she was looking around, but she wasn't. She had no cognitive ability, but she had periods of wakefulness and periods of sleep, and they were alternating. That's a persistent vegetative state. That person is not terminally ill. That person is hopelessly ill. So differentiate between kumva ase and shevi al tase, between somebody who's terminally ill, somebody who's hopelessly ill. She would never recover from that condition, but she's not terminally ill. Somebody with hopelessly, go ahead, actually.
Maybe I'm interested in some directions of those. But I got the impression from him that with someone in PBS, if you like prick them with a needle, they'll react, versus someone who's brain dead, they won't react.
Somebody with PBS might have a reflex response, I think, from the brainstem or from the spinal cord. I don't think they have a cognitive awareness, presumed from PBS. PBS.
They don't know that it hurts.
Correct. There may be, in other words, you can arouse them. Maybe you can maybe stimulate them a little bit and arouse them, although usually not to my knowledge, but they wouldn't have any awareness of that sensation.
Okay.
My understanding. It's a good point. To my knowledge, to my knowledge, BMS patients, in terms of the definition,
right.
In terms of the definition, clinical definition, have no cognitive awareness and no appreciation of pain. That's why I mention it halakhically, because one of the major contributing factors to the poskim who permit shevi al tase at times and withholding treatment is because of the pain that the person is experiencing, and that we either have the right or obligation to alleviate that pain, and by prolonging their life, we will be prolonging their pain. Somebody who's in a persistent vegetative state, by classical criteria, doesn't have any pain. And therefore, whether or not that kind of patient, maybe there's an argument that we should be more aggressive in keeping them alive longer because they're not suffering. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the differences. And then, yes?
How do we know?
There are clinical ways to diagnose and determine. I'm not sure. I have to tell you what next time I speak to Rabbi Reichman, I'll ask him what he's referring to, because you can examine the patient and stimulate them and pinprick and things like that and see if they respond, number one. Number two, if the cerebral cortex, which is where the appreciation of sensations would occur, if that has been damaged irreversibly, then by definition they can't. That's the definition of cerebral cortex global, if you will, cerebral cortex damage irreversibly, and you can clinically assess that. So I'm not sure. Have you mentioned that? Because I'm going to look into that myself. But to my knowledge, a PBS patient, by definition, in terms of the clinical criteria, someone who has no appreciation of pain. Maybe they can be, if you will, if you stimulate that, maybe a spinal cord reflex, but not an appreciation of pain. And the way you can do so, one of the ways, oftentimes, one of the ways you can tell whether a person is in discomfort or not is if they grimace. Even if they're unconscious, they can still oftentimes experience pain. So that sometimes you'll see patients, this is very common, you'll see them grimacing and making facial movements as an expression of discomfort. People in PVS do not do that. They don't grimace. They don't respond to pain. So I'm not sure what, you know, I'm going to ask Dr. Reichman about what he was referring to. But to my knowledge, by definition, and it would be clinically assessed. I'm not sure what that response that you're referring to is, because to my knowledge, you can maybe wake them up, but that's a brainstem function. You can arouse them because they can be awake. But somebody who's in pain, if you stick them if you pinprick them, they won't just wake up. They may have a different kind of response. It would be a response that expresses that they're in pain or anguish.
I was saying that you can't show, if the person's not conscious to show response with a voice, well, I didn't feel pain, then...
A person can be unconscious, but as long as the cerebral cortex part that's functioning and experiencing pain can still express it. I mean, the person doesn't have to be conscious to still have certain higher brain functions, meaning one component of the cerebral cortex function is cognition, which is, you know, what we're all engaging in right now. But there are other functions like experiencing and appreciating pain. A person doesn't have to be conscious and have cognitive ability to be able to appreciate painful or other stimuli, and will express or manifest that clinically based on clinical examination. You can arouse somebody, meaning because somebody who's in PVS has wakeful periods, and you can maybe wake them up. Perhaps, maybe that's what Dr. Reichman is referring to. That I have to have you mention. I'm going to check into that as well. Okay. If I have anything more, I can always share with Ezra and get back to you. Okay. So let's start going through some of the Mikoros, which we'll obviously only do to an extent. The first page just talks about goses, just defining goses. The reason why goses is important is because of this din shulchan aruch, which we're going to come to in a few pages, but just to go through the definition of goses. What is a goses? A goses is defined loosely, very loosely, because the overall consensus in poskim is that it's really hard to really, no pun intended, pinpoint, we're talking about pinpricking, so pinpoint the exact definition of goses. Ramosha talks about, I think in his Chuvis, that Chevra Kadisha years ago had a better sense of what goses is. He talks about the fact that for medical personnel today, it's not as important. There is such a concept in medicine and in bioethics of people who are actively dying, and there certainly are clinical manifestations of people who are in the process of dying. Certain modes of breathing pattern are indicative of somebody who's in the stages near death. But in terms of defining it so precisely medically, that doesn't exist quite the same way as it is important in halacha because of some of the dinim associated with goses. So goses is somebody, loosely speaking, somebody who is, if you will, in the process of dying, is close to death. And you'll see that in a few pages. But here, in Hilchos Gittin, the Shulchan Aruch says that a goses, harehu kachai, v'yachol lagarish, that somebody who's a goses is considered to be a fully living person and therefore has the capacity halachically to issue a divorce. There may be a reason why he wants to do so. Maybe because he wants to save his wife from Yibum, for example. Why is the goses? Goses in the middle of dying. Why is he so interested in divorcing his wife? The answer is that maybe he wants to save her from Yibum, for example. So, and you see from this Mechaber, as is pointed out in some of the sources I gave you, that the definition of goses does not require somebody who is unconscious or unaware. A person can be fully conscious, fully aware, fully lucid, and able to understand what they're doing. Otherwise, they can't issue a get. So you see, goses does not require somebody to be unconscious, somebody to be unable to speak, somebody who is unable to articulate. You see, the goses can be fully functioning and is considered therefore to be kechai l'chol dvarav. So the Ramah gives you a little bit of a definition of goses. Pirish targum al tzei chamana goses in klomer al chazeh shalehen. The chazeh is the chest. The inyan goses hu shehakarov l'misa, somebody who's near death, mala lecha v'grono, generates a lot of secretions, which is not uncommon for people towards the end of the death. They generate a lot of secretions. They can't control their secretions. They can't swallow their secretions. And therefore, they can't clear their secretions so much. That's why it's not common that people would need assistance in having their secretions cleared by nursing personnel. So the fact that karag mala lecha begronum pneitzaris hachazeh, because difficulty breathing, or perhaps more so because difficulty clearing those secretions in terms of how we normally clear our secretions. We clear our secretions by swallowing them, largely. So goses is based on chazeh, the chest, breathing, and secretions. If you look at the next page in Encyclopedia Talmudit, they give you just in their heading, Adam Samach Lemisos, again, a person near death, Keshekol Gerono Nishma, where the voice of his throat is heard. There's a certain sound, which is oftentimes consistent with people who are end of death. They may make certain noises as they're breathing, as they're kind of gasping and breathing. There is that noise, the rattle, the death rattle, that's, I think, sometimes referred to. And it gives you other definitions of that as well, and so you can have further resources in the Encyclopedia Talmudit. If you go to the third page, next page, Shulchan Aruch, Gesundheit, Shulchan Aruch, Dine HaGoseis, the laws of a Goseis. Why is Goseis so important? So in Shulchan Aruch it says, HaGoseis Areyu Kuchai L'chol Devorov, which we just saw in the Mechaber regarding Gerishin, considered to be fully alive. And therefore all the halachas applied. And therefore one has to be assured that one doesn't treat the person as if they're dead, either out of disrespect. It's another thing, it happens quite often. You're in the room, the patient is perhaps in the process of dying, maybe unconscious, and family members will ask you about what chapel, what do we do? And from Shulchan Aruch, you certainly get the clear impression that that's not appropriate to do. It's oftentimes uncomfortable when the rabbis ask, oftentimes, and you want to say to yourself, there's no rush right now, we're in the patient's proximity, let's focus on the patient, we don't have to worry, but we can always call a chapel. It doesn't take long to call a chapel when need be. Chevra Kadisha is always available. But nonetheless, so at those times, you have to be sensitive to the family also. They're under stress. You can't just say, this is not appropriate to talk about. You can say, you know what, maybe if you want, we can go outside and talk about it in the hall rather than right in the presence of the patient. But nonetheless, Shulchan Aruch gives you all the details of what you're supposed to and not supposed to do for goses. Go to the next page. The focus I wanted to talk to you about now, which is a very important Ramah, is the following. You look at the Ramah of Yesh Omrim. Okay, it talks about other things you shouldn't do until the person dies. There where it's underlined, right after he quotes from Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, V'chein Asur, it's prohibited, says the Ramah, Ligrom. Ligrom means to indirectly cause. Ligrom, groma. V'chein Asur Ligrom L'meis Shiyamus Meher. It's forbidden to cause, even indirectly, that the person should die quicker. Kagon, Mishu who goseis Zman Aruch, somebody who's been a goseis for an extended period of time. V'lo yuchal lihipart, and just unable to depart. Aser lehishamet hakar v'akesis mitachtov, is forbidden to remove the pillow or the cushion from underneath him. Mikoch, based on what? What would be the rationale for doing so? Mikoch, based on the force, meaning based on the argument, she'omrim she'esh notzos mikzas ofel, there are some feathers of some of the birds of which this pillow is composed, that are somehow stimulating him. That maybe there's something still stimulating his brainstem and keeping him awake, keeping him alive. And if you would remove those pillows, you would remove that which is stimulating him and allow him to pass away. So you can't do that because that's like a groma. Because you're indirectly, even so you're not directly, you're not shooting the person, you're not doing anything actively, directly. You're doing something active, yes. You're not doing something direct. Nonetheless, it's also not permitted to move the goseis. That's discussed a lot in halacha. If somebody is a goseis, so what do you do? You can't move them out of the room. You can't move them what if the person's in the intensive care unit, they're a goseis, and what if they want to move the patient out of the intensive care unit because they have another patient who can benefit more from the intensive care unit, and you want to move the goseis out to another floor. they can perhaps get the same level of treatment they're getting on another floor, and they want to use the bed for somebody who needs it, who's critically ill, but is perhaps salvageable. So that's based on this Ramah, discussions regarding that. V'chein lo yizenu mimkom. V'chein asur, it's also forbidden l'sum maftechos beis haknesis, tachas rosha, to put the keys of the shul under his head, kidei sheyipare, so that he should depart. Avol miyesham, for some reason that was considered to be, I'm not familiar with the background of that, why the keys to the shul would cause him kidei sheyipare, that would help him. Because again, you're doing something active, even though it's indirect. Avol says the Ramah, im yesham dover shigorim ikuv yitzias nefesh. What if there's some other factor that it itself is indirectly preventing the passing of the person? Kigom sheish somuch laoso bais kol dofek. Reminds you of the Rav's work, kol dodi dofek. Sheish somuch laoso bais kol dofek. You have some kind of pounding sound. I don't know if they're doing the construction here, but down at Stern College they're, you probably know, they're renovating the whole lobby area. There's pounding and drilling all over the place. So that can it can certainly annoy you, but apparently it can also keep you alive. Also, by cold dofek, this pounding sound, somebody who's chopping wood, and this is again stimulating the person and keeping them alive. Oshiyesh melach al lashon, there's salt on his tongue, which again is a stimulant and is keeping the person alive. Ve'elu ma'akvim yitzias hanefesh, and these are inhibiting the death. So mutter lahasiro, that says the Ramah, those impediments, those indirect impediments to death, the wood chopper, the salt on the tongue, those you're permitted to remove. De'ein bazem ma'isiklal, because this is not considered to be a kumbase at all, not even indirectly, it's not even considered a grama. El shemeser hamoneah, that's the key word that you should walk away from this Ramah, shemeser hamoneah, that you're just removing the impediment. You're not doing anything to the person directly or indirectly, you're removing the impediment. Now you should know this Ramah is discussed extensively in terms of how you view a ventilator. I'm sure last week you talked about ventilators, Rabbi Reichman, in terms of some of the criteria of brain death, but nonetheless, if a person is attached to a ventilator, so in bioethics, in general bioethics, removing, disconnecting the ventilator is considered to be passive. It's not considered to be an active form of euthanasia. It's considered to be a passive form, because all you're doing is removing the impediment. The reason the person is going to die, the argument that's made by a bioethicist, is that when you remove the ventilator, the person is going to die because of their underlying disease. Let's say it's a pneumonia. Let's say it's whatever it may be. They're going to die because of their underlying disease. It's not because you remove the ventilator. Your removal of the ventilator just allows the underlying disease process to run its course. But you haven't caused the death of the patient. In halacha, that is presumed, according to most poskim, that's not the correct analysis according to halacha. But one could make the argument, as some do, minority do, shemeser amoneah, that a ventilator is just a moneah. It's just preventing the death of the person. Halachically, we assume not so, and I would never be comfortable, and I would never recommend, except under there are certain ways to wean a patient off a ventilator. That's a different thing. But to just remove a ventilator, knowing likely that the patient will die because they're not able to breathe adequately on their own, remove that would not be considered meiser hamoneah, but that depends on how you analyze this phrase in the Ramah. Shemeiser hamoneah, you're removing the impediment. Most poskim do not assume a ventilator is an impediment, for reasons perhaps we'll get to later. So that's an important Ramah. So I want to going to take a question. Just want you to look on the side, on the right hand margin in the base Lechem Yehuda, in the middle, where he says Mikolach Sheomrim Sheish Notzos, by virtue of the fact that they say there are some feathers that are keeping him alive. Someone had a question though, Chris. Right. Right.
On the tongue. Is that the case? Or you're actually taking a piece of salt off the tongue?
Okay, so we're going to...
just not putting more and more on the tongue.
Okay, so we'll come to that in just a moment then. Somebody have another question? Okay, so before I go to the base of the Yehuda then, just to answer your question, if you look on the top left-hand column in the Taz, we call Shom Shesh Notzel. So the Taz questions this question, practice of removing the salt. Taz asks, where is it? Taz writes in the fourth line there, Shalidei Zem Mezes Guf. He asks, why is it that you're not allowed to remove the pillows with the feathers? Why isn't that just a maser monea? If the feathers are keeping the person alive, so they're impeding his death, so why not just remove the pillows? So the Taz explains, kom kan osir, in the fourth line, kivin shal yideze, mezis gufo. Because in order to get to the pillows, you'll have to move the body. You're removing the pillows from underneath him means the body is going to be manipulated, it's going to be moved. And that's kirav miso b'yadayim. Anytime I move the body, that itself, and it's true, it is true medically, that if a patient is truly a goses, certainly at ein stages, manipulating, washing, whatever it is to the patient can certainly accelerate their death. So that's why I'm removing the pillows. So then the Taz continues with your question. The kasha li, lama hitir hasaras melach me'alashon, so why are you allowed to remove the salt? Isn't that also v'logam shum mezis piv? You're also moving the mouth a little bit. V'avikem amitz einov. It's like closing the eyes, which the mechaber quoted earlier. V'alkein nearly nesach shein linhog heter. V'asaris mel. He says you shouldn't rely. He disagrees with that view. But if you look at the shach on the side, the shach quotes the kasha from the Teres de Kenim about the salt. So he says the lo kasha midi. The hacha einu iser mishum hanotzus. El iser mishum isnonei agoses. No, he doesn't say that. No, he doesn't quote. Who quotes that? So that's where I wanted to go to now. Based on Yehuda, if you look on that side, thank you, in the right-hand column. So that's the Taz. So the based on Yehuda comments that linear demuter from the Ramah. Because where did that salt come from? Tzarech lomar, Koshkasuv, I'm not sure what the name of that sefer is, that Oser laharchik misoso. I don't think that's sifalik, because I didn't see that in sifalik. Kamosh, that Oser laharchik, that's an important phrase. Oser laharchik misoso. It's forbidden to prolong his death. That's a term that's oftentimes used in medical ethics. Prolonging death. Oser laharchik mitzoso. He says you're not allowed to extend their life because you're only distancing, you're prolonging the death process. You're not supposed to put the salt there to begin with, so that he shouldn't die. On the contrary, that was wrong. Initially, the placement of the salt was inappropriate. They put it there to begin with. So you put it there to begin with inappropriately, so you're allowed to remove it. You're allowed to remove it because it's just an impediment. And it was put there inappropriately to begin with. You just have to make sure that you don't move them. You take it very gently. You take off with. You take the salt very simply, very carefully, very gently. Because of the Sefer Chassidim, you shouldn't scream at the time of Nisiyas Neshama as an expression of mourning, Kadesh lo tachzor ha-neshama, because that may cause, again, stimulate the neshama. Neshama may come back. V'tisbo yisurim kashim, and experience tremendous pain. Ramosha uses this Sefer Chassidim to explain that that's why his opinion is that certainly in certain situations it's not only permitted but obligatory to stand back and not be too aggressive, because what you're doing is causing, as the Sefer Chassidim says, yisurim kashim, very extreme situations and experiences of pain. So the comparison to ventilators, though, again, is different. Some might say, well, if the ventilator was placed there, because oftentimes that's a dilemma. In bioethics, it's not a dilemma. Bioethics, if you put a ventilator there because you're not sure, put a person on a ventilator, you're not sure if it's going to help or not. Turns out it doesn't help, so you can always remove it. Halachically, though, we assume that once the ventilator is connected to the person, disconnecting it is more than just a maser hamonea. It's considered to be a form of gram misa at the very least. So therefore, the issue always comes up, putting the patient on the ventilator to begin with. So you can't compare it. I think some posts maybe quote the idea. You can't compare it to the melach, namely the salt. The melach was put there inappropriately, so you're supposed to remove it. So the ventilator is put there, in retrospect, inappropriately, so you can remove it. But there's a fundamental difference between a ventilator and salt, and hopefully we'll clarify that as we go along. This is the Ramah. This is the importance of a goses, that you're not allowed to cause the goses. So defining a goses is important for this reason. As we will hopefully continue to develop, halach l'mais, it's really not as important to identify whether a person is a goses or not, because generally speaking, the poskim don't distinguish that much between a goses and a non-goses. as long as the person is terminal or has other criteria that the person fulfills and satisfies, same halachas generally apply. It just happens to be that there are specific halachas that apply to a goseth, but these end-of-life issues are not exactly the same. The halacha, there is certainly the concept of lo yezizenu, that in any way to move a goseth is a goseth halacha. Somebody who has terminal cancer but is not yet a goseth, you're allowed to move them, you're allowed to touch them, you're allowed to interact with them. A goseth is lo yezizenu. That's a special halacha of a goseth, and therefore it's important to know when a goseth does exist and when it's not a goseth. But in terms of gram misa, it doesn't matter whether the person is a goseth or not. And in terms of being meisir hamoneya, removing impediment, poskim assume it doesn't make any difference whether it's a goseth or not, generally speaking. If you're allowed to remove the impediment for goseth, for somebody who's a non-goseth, who's terminally ill and suffering, one would be permitted to be meisir hamoneya as well. Yes?
So, following this logic, does that mean that generally speaking, you can kind of DNR for like relatives?
Okay, so we're going to hopefully still come to that as we progress.
They saw me who just cited Usher or Harshu Gekhanisa.
Right.
And I just did a bari to see where it's from. And yeah. Typically, Ezra assumes he meant Sif Aleph.
Sif Aleph?
So it's not there. And he points out it's not there.
Yeah, okay. okay. All right. Good.
He doesn't like it.
Uh-huh.
So is there a source for, other than the Sefer Chassid, not to yell because he sees an epic? Do whatever you can as long as possible.
Well, okay, yes.
There's no indication in Shulchan Aruch.
So that it's a chiyuv. You want to know where the chiyuv is?
No, where it's usher lahartik es hamisa.
Right.
Meaning, or...
Right, so when the Ramah says that im yesham dovash, that he says that mutter lahasiro. So even if you don't accept that concept of usher lahartik misaso, but if you just look at the Ramah says that a moneya, one is permitted, as you correctly point out, mutter lahasiro misham. So you want to, so that's a similar idea, basically. Mutter lahasiro means I'm permitted to remove an impediment to the person's death, which means that I won't be prolonging his dying process, so I'm mutter. So you want to know where is the source that says that it's a chiyuv to do so. Because the Sefer has, the way based on Yehuda quotes, it's osir laharchik, which means that it would be a chiyuv to remove an impediment. You want to know where is the source for the chiyuv to remove the impediment.
Or at least the iser to
laharchik. Which would be reflected in the chiyuv to remove the moneya. In other words, how would it manifest? What does it mean? How would that manifest? Assuming, let's say there is an absolute ironclad source for that concept of Aser Laharchik Misoso. That would manifest in what way? Meaning that I'm not supposed to be aggressive in the treatment. I'm not supposed to, let's say, maybe give the person antibiotics, or I'm not supposed to hook them up to a ventilator, or I'm not supposed to resuscitate them, whatever those would be. So what?
So
correct.
Tells you to put them on, but once they're hooked up, I couldn't take them.
Yeah, because that's gram misa. That's usher elite.
No, even if we consider usher samaneya, there's a difference between usher laharchik and mutter misa roneya.
Right, but what if the Ramah would have said chayiv lahasir hamoneya? Wouldn't that be the same? Wouldn't that be like the flip side of usher laharchik?
I can see a difference, but
okay,
close enough.
Okay.
Is there another
so yes. So we're gonna hopefully get there.
Earlier.
Yes. Yes. Oh, okay. Okay. So I want you to actually. I want you to skip a few pages so we can go to that. Then we'll come back to the other pages. Just to answer that question, go to the Gemara in Ksuva, Daf Kuf Dalet. Let's go to that real quick. It's several pages later. Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph and Ksuvis, and then we'll come back to the other sources. It's probably about 10 pages later. Ksuvis Kuf Dalet Amud Aleph. Okay, everybody with me? So you look at the top. Hahu Yoma Denoch Nafshei DeRebi Gazru Rabbanan Tanisa. The day that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi died, the Rabbanan instituted fasting, and they were asking for rachamim, they were davening. Anyone who's going to give up hope and say that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi has died, will be pierced with the sword. Slika amse de Rebbe. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's amse, his housekeeper, went up le'igra to the roof, and she was davening. Amra, she said, El yonim evakshinis Rebbe, the El yonim meaning Shemayim, they want Rebbe. v'hatachtonim, namely the Talmidim, you know, the other Rabbanim. They want to keep Rebbe, Mevakshinis Rebbe. So there's a battle going on, as she describes, between Shemayim and Oretz, in terms of whether Yerushalayim is going to live or die. Yiratzon, it should be the will of God, Shiyakufu tachtonim es alyonim, that the tachtonim, that we should win, and we our davening should prevail, and we should be able to retain Rebbe Danasi. But then she changed her mind. Kivin de Chazoi, which makes her view even more legitimate. Kivin de Chazoi, Kama Zimni de Ayla Beisakise. But once she observed how frequently Rebbe Danasi was going to the bathroom, Rashi explains, De Choli Me Ayim Havilei. He had some kind of intestinal disease. Rebbe Tendler used to say that he had stomach cancer or intestinal cancer. I don't know how one can assume for sure it was this or that necessarily. Maybe because he's assuming if it was terminal, then what did he have? Then it was either stomach cancer, gastric cancer, stomach cancer, or some other kind of intestinal cancer. But nonetheless, he was having, either because of the primary disease or complications, he was having frequent bowel movements. He was having a very uncomfortable time. So what did she see? So she saw, the Sugmar says, going back to the Mar, she saw how frequently he would go to the bathroom, and he would remove his tefillin, and then put it back on, and then take it back off, and put it back on, take it off, the komit star, and how uncomfortable he was. So I would have assumed that the mitzdar means that he was in physical pain. Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi says, it was just so uncomfortable to have to take off the tefillin, put it back on, take it off, put it back on, take it off, put it back on. Tosus discusses, that's an Orach Chaim medical halacha, how is he allowed to daven in the tefillin? If a person says Shulchan Aruch, the person is potter, and according to many poskim, also to put on tefillin, a person has cholim me'ayim. Which may be relevant if somebody goes for a colonoscopy or examination before, and they have to get prepped and they have to take certain solutions or other things, and it generates frequent bowel movements, whether in terms of davening, in terms of tefillin, things like that. So that's a different issue. But Torah Rashi says the tsar was more, in a sense, almost like a psychological pain, having to take off tefillin, put it on, a physical and psychological pain perhaps. Be it as it may, she changed her mind. Omer, she said, "Yir etzon, may it now be the will." I changed my mind, she said. Shiyakufu elyonim esetachton. The Shemayim should win this battle. They should be victorious. They should prevail. But v'lohavu shaski rabbonim v'lo yirachmi. But the other rabbonim, the other tanoim, felt not so, and they continued to daven. She's one person against a whole kollel, so whose tefillos are going to be accepted? So, but she was very, very creative. Shakla kuza, so she took a pitcher, some kind of pitcher, earthenware pitcher, shadya migra, she dropped it, threw it from the rooftop, la'ara, and obviously it shattered, and at the time that it shattered, the Talmidim were startled by it. They stopped saying Tehillim for a few minutes, a few moments, ishtiku, mirachame, then v'noch nafshei derebi, and he died. That's what the Gemara says. So it's based on this Gemara is one of the primary, if not the primary source, because the Ran quotes this Gemara in the Dorn. Some of the sources I give you refer to that Ran as well, that this is the source for the concept of number one, first and foremost. That's what the Ran says in the Dorim. That Ran is, I think, in Daf Mem in the Dorim, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, Daf Mem, I believe. This is Daf Kuf Dalis. That's Daf Mem in the Dorim, I believe, where the Ran says, based on the Gemara there, the Gemara talks about that somebody who doesn't go to visit a chole is doing a double disservice to the person, who's sick. Number one, Gemara says, he's not davening for the person that he should have refuah shleima, that he should yichya. Number two, he's not davening for the person shiyamos, that he should die. So it's a double disservice. Not helping the person either way. So the Ran explains, what do you mean not davening for the person that he should die? Davening for the person that he should live. So the Ran says, oh, you see from this Gemara, the Amsei Derebi, that sometimes it's appropriate to daven. The Ran is postulating like Amsei Derebi against the other Tanoim. The Amsei Derebi, having had a better clinical knowledge of what was going on with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, having observed what was going on in his pain, that's an important principle as well, to have the proper medical and clinical awareness of what's going on, her assessment was that he's better off dying than continuing to live because of the tsar, whatever that tsar was, whatever the nature of that tsar was, but that tsar dictates that the davening should be. So that's why the Ran says, sometimes it's appropriate and obligatory to daven that a person should die. So that's where Moshe then extrapolates from that, that not only in terms of davening, but withholding treatment. That's what we're going to see in some of the next tshuva. So going back to where we left off with in pages before, after that Yoredei Ramah, let's go back to some of the other literature. That next page, Igros Moshe, Shin Yud Zayin, Choshen Mishpat, I forget which chelek of Choshen Mishpat, I think this is Choshen Mishpat chelek Beis. Ramosha at the end of Choshen Mishpat chelek Beis has a whole series of tshuvas on end-of-life issues, worthwhile to go through. So he talks a little bit more about goses. You can read more about goses and defining goses. If you want that tshuva, go to the next page.
Wait, so the modern tshuvas, what are the wrong
that
his mother was right?
That the housekeeper of Rebbe was correct, that her approach, her original approach was the same. But then when she saw how much tzar Rebbe Yonah Nasi was in, she changed her view and she started to daven that he should die. Naran, and you see, therefore, and the Gemara doesn't criticize her. Right. Gemara kind of ends the story that way. Well, the Gemara goes on to how the information was conveyed to the other Tannaim, right. But the Gemara seems to be taking the view. Some question. I think that Tzitz Eliezer questions whether the Gemara accepts Amtsi. But Pashup Shah, and that's how Rav Moshe assumes for sure, and that's how the Ran clearly assumes for sure, that the Gemara accepts the halacha Amtsi de Rebbe's reversal of her approach, namely that you should daven that he should die. Therefore, says the Ran, it's appropriate to daven sometimes if a person is terminally ill, komitzar harve, and is in a lot of pain and distress, and they're better off dying than continuing to suffer like that. There are situations like that, and therefore it would be better a person should die, and therefore it's appropriate to daven that the person should die. So the extension of that, let's just go on the next page. We'll skip also a little bit more about goses. So we'll skip that, go to the next page. We'll skip that one too. The next two pages. That din of the... In Hilcha Shabbos, there's an important bir halacha, but we'll skip that as well. These photocopies next, and 371, 372, 374, are from Dr. Steinberg's encyclopedia. Encyclopedia Halachatit Rufuit. That has also been translated by Dr. Rosner into English as well. It's a 6-volume Hebrew, 3-volume English, I believe. So also some things about goses a little bit more. We can skip that in the next two pages. If you go to Ramosha's Chuvas, now going back to Ramosha's Chuvas. Yes?
Ramosha only says that by a case of someone who's terminally ill, because you don't know if they knew that Rebbe was terminally ill. Even if they're not terminally ill, how do we know that they knew that Rebbe was terminally ill?
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. That's a good question. Right, so Rosha does say it by somebody who's terminally ill. If you look, I'll tell you which tshuva I want you to look at in Ramosha first. It's the tshuva Igros Moshe Choshen Mishpat, page Shin Dalet. Ramosha didn't write Shin, they wrote Dush, Dalet Shin, not to use shade. Shin. So if you look, it's a few pages right after the Teferis Yisrael, the Mishnah in Yuma. It's a few pages later. I'm sorry I have that order. I have it here. I should have put it in a different order. But if you look at Igros Moshe, Choshen Mishpat, page Shin Dalet, or Dalet Shin, you have that? It's the right-hand column, the top right-hand column, Os Aleph, or Simon Aleph. Im Yesh Cholim, are there any patients, She'en Litein Lehem Trufot Laharachas Chayehem? Are there any patients to whom you should not give medication or treatment to extend their life? Everyone have it? So let's go through that paragraph quickly together. Not to give them any medical treatments, to extend their life longer. So Ramosha is interpreting it that way. You asked me how to know it's terminal. Good question. That their tefillos were helping that he wasn't dying, but it wasn't helping that he was in any way recovering. I guess from the perspective of the fact that Amtsi Rebbe saw that his condition was still as bad as it was before, with having to go to the bathroom on and off. The Gemara doesn't exactly. Yeah. So that's how, maybe that's how Ramosha deduced from that he was terminal, because otherwise, if the tefillos were helping that he was living, why didn't the tefillos help that he would recover? By virtue of the fact that he wasn't, meaning that he must have been terminal because the symptoms continued as observed by Amtsi de Rebbe. That's how Ramosha assesses it to answer your question. But how did Rav Moshe understand? How do you know for sure that's what the Gemara meant? So that's how Rav Moshe understood it. Avoloshi Yisrape. So you have a situation that Tfilos can help that he's not going to die, but not that he's going to in any way recover or reverse. He's terminally ill. And Kesharos Am Tadrebi Shemistar Tuva Amra She said Yehi Ratzom. Close the whole Gemara. But not Katzah Gemara Lashma Inon. There are times that one is required. Number one, the person's in distress. So in the medicine, the medical treatments don't help to in any way cure or offset or reverse even a little bit the actual condition, just extending his life. She was certainly well versed. Other things, and then he refers you to that Ran and Daf Mem based on the Gemara we just described. Go to the bottom of that paragraph, the last 10-12 lines. Uveinchi ki haygavna, in the middle of a line, it's after a comma, and people like this, Shaharofim Makirin, that the doctors recognize, she efshar lo lihisrapos lichios, that this person can never recover or live. And the person can't even live without pain. You can give him some medication to extend or prolong his life, but not alleviating the pain. One should not give him those treatments. Leave him the way he is. Leave them the way they are. To give the person a medicine, to give them deliberately an overdose of morphine to cause their breathing to stop. That, for that purpose, that's also, says Rav Moshe, clearly. Even to do any action that will even indirectly shorten, even for a moment, that's considered murder. Don't treat. So Rav Moshe makes that extrapolation regarding usur laharich misaf. So that's what Rav Moshe is saying, that you're not allowed to. Rav Moshe ain't li ten lo mini refuos liyanidlum avolim ikasam refeshe yekilu b'yisurin. If there's something you can give them that can alleviate the pain, then definitely you should do so. That's for sure. Lekatzur af rega mechav tzarach laasuk kishya dain ain't a goseis. Moshe adds in, because you're dying in a ghost. But clearly, from that, for most, you see, that's why I said ghost is not as practically relevant in terms of basic end-of-life care, because Moshe is not saying the only person that you don't have to treat is somebody who's a ghost. Anybody, in fact, Moshe at the end, that's a different question what Moshe means at the end, Moshe is talking about somebody who specifically is not yet a ghost. He clearly says that. So the concept of Meser Monea applies to goseis, non-goseis alike, as long as, number one, Rav Moshe says the person is unable to recover, they are terminally ill, and number two, mitzdar harbe. When you have those two criteria, namely, yesher sheyichya, he's terminal, and kemitzdar, and he's in pain, then not only is it appropriate to pray, and daven, the person shouldn't live, it's appropriate to withhold treatments. That's exactly what Rav Moshe writes.
But you have to give routine pain pills.
Okay, so go to the next page then. That's good, thank you. Go to the next page by Nishmas Avram, Dr. Abraham, who quotes from Shlomo Zalman Orbach. That's another excellent safe. If you're looking for what you should have in your library for halacha and refuah, so the essentials are Nishmas Avram, 5-volume work by Dr. Abraham, which has also been translated by Dr. Abraham into English, and the Encyclopedia Talmudit of Dr. Steinberg is an essential. They're very different works. They have different goals. One is encyclopedic. One follows Shulchan Aruch, sif by sif, and talks all about halach is related. Those are two essential modern works to have in your library. The single best work in English on bioethics is still the one that was written first by Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz, Lord Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Jacobowitz, in the 1950s as a PhD thesis. It's still the single best work in Jewish bioethics. It's called Jewish Bioethics. It's still very important. There's still things important. But in terms of what you just mentioned, Ezra, if you look everyone at the bottom of page Reish Mem Hey in Nishmas of Rum, we quote the very last line, Omer Li Agon Shlomo Zalman Orbach Shlita. Let me just read this and then come to your questions, if you don't mind. Shitzrichim Lahavdil, you have to distinguish between the following. And I'd like to give you what I think Rav Shlomo Zalman is suggesting. Shitzrichim Lahavdil, maybe it's obvious. Pain Tipulim, between treatments, interventions. Hamimalim, Srachov, Hativiyim, Al Shalachola, the natural, normal, biologic needs of a person. All hamikubalim kishigra time are those that are considered to be accepted as routine. Uvein tipulim between treatment shemi chutz legeder hashigra. In general bioethics, the term is heroic measures, those which are not considered part of routine. How we define heroic and how the general bioethics community defines heroic is a little bit disparate, but nonetheless, the concept is the same. That Rishlomo, or at least similar. Shlomo Zalman says that those treatments that are part of the routine, part of natural biologic needs, teva tiviyim, those you have to continue to do. Those that are mechutz legeder, you don't. L'chein, so he gives you some examples. And each one you can analyze. L'chein cholu l'mashal, hasovil misartan, who suffers from cancer. Shehispashe pigufo, that has spread in his body, meaning it's metastasized. V'karav l'misa, and he's near death. Al afshe yeshlo yisurim, ukevim kashim, even though he is tremendously in pain, aser lahafsik lo, it's forbidden to stop or interrupt, olim noamim enu chamtzan, to hold from him oxygen. Because oxygen is a normal biologic need. Every human being needs oxygen. It's not something specific to somebody who's ill. Everybody needs oxygen. We are constantly inhaling oxygen, otherwise we could not survive. So oxygen is necessary. Ramush is not saying a ventilator. Chamtzan is different than a ventilator. You can give somebody oxygen without putting them on a ventilator. You can always give somebody supplemental oxygen with a mask or with a nasal cannula. We're talking about just giving oxygen. Rav Moshe is not talking about a ventilator. Chamtzan is oxygen. O kol mazon, or any nutritional need, o nozel, or even liquid nutrition, mizin acher, shelehem hu zakuk, that's necessary. That's an important point as well. You may or may not know, Rav Schechter has at least suggested an alternate view of this in terms of nutrition. Maybe if we have a chance, we'll come back to it. Ein lahafsikis matan dam, you shouldn't stop giving blood, namely transfusions. Because Shlomo Zalman is, again, understanding that what is a transfusion? You'll say, well, a transfusion is a major procedure, which it is. Giving somebody blood transfusion is a major procedure. It takes several hours. It's a whole process in a hospital giving transfusions. But nonetheless, blood is something that's basic. It's teva. It's a natural need of every human being. Every person needs blood because the blood carries the oxygen, and therefore it's considered to be tivi. It may not be considered shigra routine. Transfusions are not necessarily considered routine in a hospital. They are on a as-per-need basis. But they're considered to be tiviyim. But then he adds another thing, so kol trufa acheris, which I think one can certainly analyze a little bit. Kigon antibiotica. Shlomo Zalman even suggests that you have to give the person, at least the way it's recorded here. You have to look at other quotations and other written statements by Shlomo Zalman and try to correlate them all and put them together. But here he's saying even antibiotics. There is a fundamental difference between a blood transfusion and an antibiotic. A blood transfusion is giving a person that which is part of the normal composition of the body, namely blood. And you're giving them because maybe they have low blood. Antibiotics, people don't normally walk around having antibiotics. We don't eat antibiotics for lunch, dinner, or breakfast. And antibiotics is something that is not, in a sense, part of the TV, part of the natural needs of a person. It only is necessary when the person has an infection, a bacterial infection that has not been able to be overwhelmed by the body's own immune system. So that's not TV. One could make the argument that antibiotics would not be considered, but Shlomo Zalman says that it is. I want you to look at the next paragraph just briefly. The third. Ode Omer Ligon Shlomo Zalman regarding morphine. Well, I'll leave it for you to look at. So I don't want to get into that right now. Regarding giving morphine and how to properly give morphine in terms of, because morphine has the ability to suppress the respiratory system, respiratory center in the brainstem, and cause a person to die. That's what you can certainly actively euthanize a person by giving too much morphine, but usually morphine is used appropriately to alleviate pain, and that's something that's essential. Always to alleviate pain. And most of the time, people don't have to be in pain if they're properly managed with pain management. Just have to be careful how you do so, so that it doesn't likely accelerate the death of the person. Yes?
So, in both from Ramos and probably the reader from Zalman, is Asr La'ari Chayav if you sow when you serve Kashrus?
Yes.
So, and you just mentioned that you thought was, I mean, today we can manage everyone's pain.
Usually.
So, and he says, if you can manage their pain, you have to.
Yes, for sure.
So, according to Ramos, there would almost never be a prohibition of extending the life. Because you can always give them pain medication.
Mm-hmm.
So practically today, that would be...
Okay, so look at the next page. Look at the next page. Idrash Moshe Choshen Mishpat, Semenai in Haitian, Test Vav, the bottom of that first column. Come back to your other question, someone else's other question in a moment. Look at the very bottom of the first column. He named Fimash in his bar, the last two lines. Gam l'rapi b'samim rapi kishi efshar el l'harach yimeich hachol ha-meshach zman. Only to prolong. Shalom Arapin. Nothing's going to reverse or cure. Ela Shemo Ilin Asam Rifua El Laharik Yimeha Chola. V'yavshar E'elu B'sam E'elu K'sha'in Marapin El Marichin Yimeha Chola B'yisurin. In pain. So Tzarek Lahadiyah Zeh Lahachol. You have to let the patient know. Assuming the patient can make their own decision. V'loch Shalom Imenu Im Rotze She'itna Lo Rifua D'sam E'elu. If he wants to. Shem b'chai yisurin rotze yosem yisuf. He wants to still continue living. Shrich nitin lo vim ein achol rotze lichus yisurin ein litin lo sem refu ele im hu lari chayev at shiyavo refu until you can, unless you can actually reverse it. So he introduces the concept of letting the person, patient, make up his or her own mind. But again, presumably only in a situation where the person is in a lot of pain. There's another tshuva of Rav Moshe, which I don't think I photocopied for you. Rav Moshe does address the issue of people not in pain. It's in these series of tshuvas at the end of Choshen Mishpat. I don't think that I photocopied that for you, but you will find it there in the Choshen Mishpat Chelek Beis. In terms of what you read. One second. I thought he did. I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure if he talks about persons not in pain. There are some other sources, though, in the packet that do address that. So let's go on. If you go to the next page. Oh, someone had a question. Yes.
Just a question.
Yeah.
When Abraham first introduced the idea. Abraham first introduced the idea, was he saying there are two separate things? There's Teva and when he said Shigra, was that
Maybe. Yeah, I think you're correct. I think in your analysis that is correct, that to them our normal body needs, which include oxygen and red blood cells and food and things like that. And then there are that Shigra time routine things. Yes, antibiotics are, you know, all over. Everybody has antibiotics in the hospital. Even if they don't need it, they get antibiotics. It's, you know, it's like a perk of being hospital. Everybody gets antibiotics. So maybe that's what it means, that it's because it's so routine, you can't withhold it. As opposed to like doing surgery, that's not routine in everybody. That's not as, you know, that's under special circumstances. That may be. I'm not sure though why that should make a difference. How would you understand? Well, again, it would either go into one category. What about hemodialysis? What about giving a person dialysis? So I would view dialysis as TV. Because the dialysis machine is doing what the person naturally, biologically can't do, namely kidney function, whatever that function is. So I would look at, it's not Shigra time, it's not routine, it's only again for a special patient population. So you're saying it's one or the other. So then it doesn't exclude a lot.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to, I don't know if we're going to get to it or not. I'm just going to refer you, there's a very... In the Tiferes Yisrael that we didn't go through is very fascinating. I just want to refer you to it because he goes through a whole analysis of Amsei de Rebbe a few pages back on Yuma. So you can look at that on your own, the Tiferes Yisrael. He makes a very important point regarding pain, the issue of Tsar, and how he analyzes Amsei de Rebbe. and how we reconcile that with the mission there in Yuma. So when you have a chance to look at that, I want to go on. In this next page of Choshen Mishpat, Shin Yud Ches, Rav Moshe talks about that notion that I talked about at the beginning, about how to always do something. There's always something you can do for the patient. Never giving the patient no hope, or never giving the patient the feeling of abandonment. It's very important. Never give the patient feeling of abandonment. It talks about a little bit there in Shin Yud Ches. If you look in the next page, should be Mincha Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. The Mincha Shlomo, thick sefer, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. So on the bottom left hand, he talks about Mishuteket. Mishuteket is somebody who's paralyzed or could become paralyzed. So he talks a little bit about that as well. And he talks a little bit about Tipul HaGoseis on the next page, Tavkuf Nun Ches, in terms of what to do. So look there on that paragraph in the first column on page Tavkuf Nun Ches and Mincha Shlomo Simen Tzadik Aleph. Rabim Isflatim Mishela Zu. So Tipul Begol Chol HaGoseis. People are since Ms. Blatim, I'm translating it as like confused, looking for, searching, find out what the proper way. It's a little bit disorienting. So he says, "Af mistaber shimachola sovel mekevim yisurim gidolim." Person is suffering from tremendous pain. O afilu savol nefesh chazak ma'od. Psychological pain. The person simply is just overwhelmed. And even if physically maybe their symptoms can be controlled, but oftentimes people are very depressed, which oftentimes can also be addressed, but not sometimes as easily as the physical pain. So he throws in that notion, he contributes that notion, afilu, he introduces, afilu saval nefesh, chazak ma'od, even if it's psychological, choshvani, she'ochel v'chamtzon, I think that food and oxygen, l'nishima chayavim li'tin lo gam neged ritzono, even against his will. That's something that Rav Moshe, one of the early tshuvas, which we didn't go through, but you'll find it there, talks about not forcibly giving somebody food. Rav Moshe also, is when Rav Schechter presented his view, remember last year I've heard it from Rav Schechter other times about his view on nutrition, so he talked about that Rav Moshe talks about that one should always give a person food and nutritional support, that should never be withheld. Rav Moshe says even intravenous nutritional support, not just giving them food to eat normally, even intravenous. Rav Moshe says not to forcibly do it against their will. Here, Rav Shlomo Zalman suggests that kam keneged ritzono. He doesn't say what that means, neged ritzono. Does it mean literally forcing him? You'll tie the person down and give it to them, or it means that you'll coerce them into accepting it. Avol mutter lihimana mitrufos hagormos saval lechol. You're allowed to withhold other treatments that will only either increase the pain or extend the pain. So he talked a little bit about that. Go to the next page. This is an important source. This source I got, you know, we're winding down. It won't cover to everything, but hopefully this is a beginning. This source is from Reb Chaim Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, from his Sefer Kovetz Igros, Karana de Igarta. This source was introduced to me by the chaplain at Parker, which is part of LI, next to LIJ. There is a Parker Nursing Center. I forget the Rav's name, but I went to a shir that he gave last year. I was invited by one of the members of the Kehillah to go. So this is one of the sources he had. This was, I think, was I found very interesting. Bar Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky. That's, I think, is the Stipler's son, no? Is the Stipler's son? Or grandson?
He's the Stipler.
Yaakov Yisrael. Oh, why am I? Chaim Kanievsky. Okay. So Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky. Thank you. Thank you very much. So in this he writes the following. Be'ikir ha'yesod. The big paragraph. Be'ikir ha'yesod l'chol ma'ashe efshar l'hari chaye cholof. To do anything that's possible to extend the life of the cholof. Filo eino el chayesha, even if it's just temporarily. Again, we didn't get into another discussion of chayesha chayolom. That's why I say you can spend chayolom talking about these issues. Tzrichin lasos. So he said that principle, that fundamental, that one is obligated to do everything. Emes shegam ani shamati b'yaldusi memra kazu, but v'lo yadati mizehu mibar samchahu. I never know if that was a reliable source. You have to always do everything. Avol be'enai dover zed tzarchi in gadol. I question that. V'yor deya simin shin lamentism for demuter lahasir dover hamoneya p'tiras hachole. Kishali deize hamoneya yisurav rabim. That's based on that Beis Lechem Yehuda. Rak maisa begufo, only do something to the person, either directly or indirectly. Begufo asr lasos. Vim kain, liyoshevi al tasa lechora, V'mokom shal dei zeh yitosu l'yisurim lo matzasi yisir. I don't find an yisir. Va'ader rabba yish lil mod limnoa mizeh ayin beis lechem Yehuda. V'yodei Hashem yirmad koch shomim she ein lo seis melech l'harich hagis sisa v'ulai go seis shiny. Throws in maybe ghost of Shishan. Rav Moshe clearly does not say ghost of is different. Avol chora kol she'enu el l'chayishah. He's just going to prolong their life a little bit. Vein bo hatzolam mamish. Domi l'nidon ha'gosei, sh'arei ha'gosei hu k'chai l'chol dor avor, and therefore why distinguish between the two? V'chol zet tzarech iyan gadol. So that's a general approach. But he doesn't go into a discussion about what is, what isn't. Just talks about some of the general principle, but it's an important makor as well. One refi as we conclude to just what's left in the packet. The next page is Kuf Nun Gimel. The bottom of the page talks about an actual maisa that was brought before Rishlomo Zalman and Rav Eliashiv, Yibodu L'chaim, by Dr. Abraham, regarding a person who suffers from ALS. ALS is also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's the disease of the central nervous system involving progressive depletion of motor neuron, nerve cells that function in the skeletal muscle system controlling, most importantly, breathing, legs, arms, so that over time, as is described here, as Dr. Abraham presents the clinical scenario, the person progressively weakens and loses function of motor, of movement, arms, legs, and eventually is unable to move at all, except for the eyelids, which the person is able to open and close and communicate that way. And eventually the person, because of difficulty breathing, because their muscle movement of the chest wall is compromised, they develop repetitive infections, pneumonias, and eventually require mechanical ventilation, ventilators. So there are two parts to the shaila that was presented to Shlomo Zalman Orach, and there's a lengthy discussion about it. Number one, about how frequently do you have to keep giving antibiotics? That antibiotic issue comes back here as well. Namely, every 2 months, the person gets a pneumonia because they can't clear their secretions properly. They develop all kinds of infections in terms of their lungs. And so do you have to keep giving the person antibiotics every 2 months, bring them into the hospital, give them antibiotics every 2 months? Number two, if the person decides that at the end stages of the disease, they don't want to be connected to a ventilator, do they have the right to do so? Sometimes people can live for years with ALS on ventilators. So the question is, do the person have the right to reject that treatment and therefore die several years perhaps earlier than they would have otherwise? So that's discussed here, Dr. Abraham, several pages. Then that article I referred to in the beginning, compliments of Rabbi Dr. Reichman, that is more of a synopsis of the larger decision of Dr. Steinberg and the Steinberg Commission regarding end-of-life issues that was accepted by the Knesset in Asia. And then regarding issues of living will, healthcare proxies, which we don't have a lot of time to really go into. Just want to conclude with 2 points, and then I'll take any other questions if you have to daven, and I'll stick around for a few minutes for other questions as well. And that is two things. Number one, it's important to understand the concept of an advanced directive. Advanced directives are instructions that a person relates while they still have capacity, that's known as decisional making capacity, while they still have the ability to make decisions, for a time when they will no longer have that decision-making capacity. As long as a person is cognitively able to make decisions for himself, these advanced directives are not operative. They have no effect or import. But they are designed to be drafted by a person when they still have cognition and decisional-making capacity for situations when they no longer will. That's an advanced directive in advance of will be in the future. There are two basic forms of an advanced directive. One is a living will, in which the person designates in detail, greater or less, what they do or don't want to have done to them at end-of-life situations or in situations where they're no longer to express their wishes. There is no law in New York State that recognizes living wills. There is precedent. There is case law, or there's precedent for it being accepted, but there's no law that mandates the living will must be recognized and honored in the state of New York, as you will see from the sources given there. The other, which is statute in New York State, is a health care proxy, where I don't express in advance what I do or don't want. A person just designates a person to take over their decisional-making process for them when they can no longer do so. The proxy, make a shliach, basically, a proxy. So that's just advanced directive, proxy, living will. You look at the RCA version, which is basically a proxy. It is not a living will fundamentally. It's basically a proxy with a little bit of a living will. You can combine the two. They're just basics. Last thing, in terms of, you asked about, someone asked about resuscitation. These issues of resuscitation would certainly be relevant here as well. I refer you, it's not in your sources, but I refer you to Nishmas Avram Chelek Hay in Yoredeya Simon Shin Lamed Tes, Sifkot and Gimel and Dr. Abraham, where he talks about somebody who had a heart attack and resuscitative efforts there, and what to do and how to maintain their blood pressure. He talks about using vasopressors if you have to keep the blood pressure up, and talks about some of those issues, which hopefully will help you clarify some of those issues. But the issues of resuscitation need to be certainly analyzed similarly to what we've done so far, but with some specific parameters to it. And hopefully some of the sources will help you for that as well. I appreciate both your feedback, your questions, and information I've gained from you, and hopefully you've enjoyed it and come out with a better appreciation, both halakhically and hashkafically.
Can you just spend 1 minute? The initial story that you told, so you said that you spoke to the pre-rushing yeshiva.
Yes.
So if you could just go through their opinions.
Okay, so both Rabbi Tendler and Rav Schechter, in that case, based on the description, this is a woman who had metastatic melanoma, who was already at that time, if I'm not mistaken, in the intensive care unit of Memorial Sloan Kettering, who was no longer, if I remember correctly, conscious. So she had been already in a deteriorating state, and the cancer had spread to, if I remember, to parts of the other body, and had been continuing to extend. She was being maintained by a ventilator. She was not able to breathe on her own. And she was not at all conscious. I don't think I was familiar with all the details. Medical situation at the time, although I probably knew more about it at that time. In either case, she was clearly, I think in that case, terminally and hopelessly ill. And the question about whether to be aggressive and continue, let's say, giving antibiotics or other treatments. I don't remember now specifically what treatments the mother wanted. I honestly don't remember. The intensive care, I think, maybe wanted to be able to disconnect her from a ventilator. But the middle ground, which is, I think, the one that Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Schechter recommended, was not being overly aggressive, meaning don't disconnect her from the ventilator, but you don't have to treat her. If her blood pressure, let's say, were to drop, you wouldn't necessarily have to give medications to reverse the blood pressure drop. Develops an infection, you wouldn't necessarily have to give antibiotics. That's approximately. I may not be recalling everything specifically accurately, so I'm not saying this halacha lemaisa that Rav Schechter and Rav Tendler said you don't have to give vasopressors, antibiotics, but just in terms of your story, just in terms of the general scheme, I still remember. But basically, Rav Tendler and Rav Schechter's approach in that case, which is why I know them to be in that regard, in that issue, certainly they are on the same page overall in terms of not being overly aggressive, being a little bit passive, still giving perhaps fluids and nutritional support. That's another detail which I don't recall that I even asked at the time. That was their approach. Rabbi Bleich's approach was to continue to be much more aggressive, because not yet a goseis necessarily. A goseis, certainly Rabbi Bleich's view of the definition of goseis, we didn't take the time to analyze that part of the definition. According to Rabbi Bleich, based on Shulchan Aruch, and you have some sources that address that debate as well, where the part of the definition of a goseis is somebody who is going to die imminently within 3 days. If the person may die in 4, 5, 6 days, then this person's not a goseis. Or, according to Rabbi Bleich, if you can reverse the gesisa and extend their life so that instead of dying in 2 days, they'll die in 4 days, then you're obligated to do that as well. So Rabbi Bleich was of the opinion that you have a chiyuv to reverse the state of gesisa. I remember this from Shiurim he gave many years ago in the Chavur program. And you'll see some sources that I think talk about that issue as well in this packet. So he felt you have to continue doing everything aggressively as much as possible, whatever that would mean. Giving vasopressors, giving antibiotics, doing everything you can, keeping her aggressively treated in the intensive care unit. That was Rabbi Bleich's approach. The ultimate approach I think that was taken, if I'm not mistaken, was, I don't remember now exactly, I think she was transferred out of the intensive care unit to another floor because she did die on another floor, not the intensive care unit. By the way, I do remember that the Satmar Bikur Cholim, I think, used to send people in to sit with her, so that she would there would always be somebody there. If I'm not mistaken, I remember them doing that as well. And eventually, she did die. I don't remember now how aggressive or not they were being. I don't honestly remember now what happened. But those were the two approaches. Rabbi Blight's something more aggressive. In fact, Rabbi Blight and the oncologist spoke. I connected them on the phone. The speaker, Rabbi Blight and the oncologist spoke together. I remember standing in the ICU there. The two of them were speaking on the phone about some of the issues. It was very, very interesting. And nonetheless, but should be a leadership show. Okay, welcome to you. Thank you very much. No, this is cool.
Next week is genetic testing. What's that? Next week is genetic testing.